How does change happen? Whether it's in public opinion, legislation, our behaviour, our communities, or just one person's life, that's our question. This is a special extended edition of Social Power, a podcast from the Sheila McKechnie Foundation. It was recorded during a half-day event sponsored by the Joseph Rowntree Reform Trust. One year ago, Ireland voted with a resounding yes to repeal the Eighth Amendment of its constitution. It paved the way for women to access legal, safe abortions. The Together for Yes campaign has been recognised all over the world for its role in delivering the result. Many commentators go further, crediting the campaign with fundamentally changing the status of women and women's rights in Ireland and beyond. A complex and challenging campaign, it built on decades of work by a diverse set of actors, interests and traditions. A year on, Irish campaigners joined us to share their learning and insights. The first part of our event focused on the Irish campaign. We were joined by Deirdre Duffy, a human rights lawyer and campaign director of the Together for Yes Coalition. Dr. Claire Brophy, co-convener of the Abortion Rights Campaign. And Rachel Lavin, data journalist and partnerships coordinator with Who Targets Me. There is so much to examine around the Together for Yes campaign that rather than jump straight into a conversation, we asked each of our guests to talk about their own experiences. These contributions are longer than our usual format, but we think you'll agree are rich in detail and ideas. First up was Deirdre Duffy, campaign director of the Together for Yes Coalition. She gave us an overview of the entire campaign journey, which started many years before the referendum.
Just before I talk maybe about the campaign and the run-up to the campaign, I just want to play you a clip, and I'm really hoping it works. And I'm going to give you a little bit of context to this in a couple of sentences. This time last year, this exact day, it was the day before, now the dates are a little bit off, but it was the day before polling day, and the moratorium kicked in at 2 p.m., and we had an opportunity to go on the lunchtime news, which is has a huge listenership, the radio news, and they had asked for the two campaign managers to give a closing statement of 1 minute each. So I'd like to play for you the two closing statements that were given by a man called John McGurk, who led the Save the Eighth campaign, and a very tired, small voice that was me. And I just listened to it again for the first time this week, and I thought, oh my God, I actually sound as though I'm going to burst into tears at one point, which I did afterwards. So I just want you to listen to this in the context of the 1 minute closing statement, 35 years since the Eighth Amendment was put into the Constitution.
So we've just a couple of minutes left until the moratorium. You've both worked really hard for your different points of view throughout this campaign. I'm going to give each of you a chance now to talk directly to the voters for 1 minute and make your final appeal to anyone who's coming out to vote tomorrow from the point of view of your proposition.
I think it's the time for anything other than straight talking is over. So I'm talking to the people now who are undecided about tomorrow and are trying to figure out what the right thing to do is. And what I say to those is that when they mark their X in the ballot paper tomorrow, they will be giving, if they vote yes, their permission and their stamp of approval, not for two or three abortions a year, but for every single abortion that happens in this country till the end of time, and they will be saying they approve of those. And they will be taking responsibility for every possibility of the kind of country that we become and the culture that we have and how we relate to unborn life. We only need to look to our nearest neighbour, where 11 babies had their lives ended last year because they had a cleft palate, and 141 had their lives ended because they were twins, and 683 had their lives ended because they had Down syndrome. And when you have abortion for any reason at all in a country, you change it irretrievably, and I'm asking people really to vote no tomorrow.
Deirdre Duffy.
I think people need to be clear what we're voting on tomorrow at the ballot boxes. Voting no means that next week 9 women will still travel to the UK for an abortion. It means that 3 women will still take an abortion pill at home, alone, without medical supervision. Voting no means that we can do absolutely nothing for women and couples who receive a diagnosis of fatal-fetal anomaly. And voting no means that we cannot provide compassionate care for victims of rape and incest. So voting no means that nothing will change. And tomorrow I'm voting yes for the women and the girls that I love. because a yes means that doctors can do their jobs. A yes means that safe and regulated abortion services exist under Irish law. And a yes means that we have a better Ireland that cares for women at a time when we need it most.
And so that's it. That was the closing line in 1 minute. And that was 1 minute where every word, every intonation, every sentence mattered. And the message that was in that 1 minute spent a journey from 1983 to 2018 through the psyche of Irish people, through laws, through process, through mobilisation, through grassroots movement. And that's where we ended up. And it wasn't just me who gave those kind of closing statements. The women of Ireland came together in the last week, and that's what we presented to the people. My only objective in going into that radio station was to sound normal, because we had it. We had the yes vote at that point, and I'm going to tell you how I know in a little bit. So I just needed to sound normal, because the other side were a little bit unhinged. They had completely fallen apart, and I will tell you about that as well. But did you hear him? He got it out there at the end. He sounded totally normal, absolutely convincing, but we still won by 66.4%. So that was Ireland last year. This is Ireland now. This is the people that we are. This is who we are. We are the country of marriage equality. We are the country where an abortion referendum, which tore us apart for 3 decades, united us. So it didn't just pass, it actually united generations of women and men. But really, this campaign was won by leaders everywhere. And I'm going to come back to that again at the end, because I think that's a very important thing in terms of social change and what type of leadership actually brings about sustainable rights-based change. That was Ireland last year in Dublin Castle. Flags were flying. It was a sea of crying, dancing, smiling women. And on the stage, when they announced the result, it was the faces of women that were to the forefront. It was a woman-led campaign according to how we do things and what our values are. But that was not always who we were. And this is Ireland 1996, was when the last Magdalen Laundry closed down. And for those of you who've never heard of these awful institutions, it's where women were sent by their families, they were incarcerated by the state in collusion with the church, and I'm deliberately using strong language there, to no fault of their own, with no trial, no provision of law, generally for sex outside of marriage, unwanted pregnancies, whatever it is. And I'm going to say it again, it was 1996 when the last Magdalen Laundry closed. It was 1983 when the Eighth Amendment was put into our constitution by a concerted strategic effort by religious conservatives. And it came about because of Roe versus Wade, which is, of course, extremely ironic given what's happening at the moment. The religious conservatives saw the impact that Roe versus Wade had in the US. We had a case in Ireland called McGee versus Ireland, which was around access to contraception, which was illegal in the 70s in Ireland. And Mrs. McGee, through her court case, the courts recognised that there was a right to marital privacy, which obviously mirrored the Roe versus Wade case. So the religious conservatives organised to put a bulwark against any recognition of abortion in our country. And in doing so, what they did with the Eighth Amendment was they put in place really an oppressive, you know, unbelievably high bar for access to abortion, which is basically the mother, the woman's life being at risk, whom they termed the mother and the unborn. So that's what we were faced with in 1983. And one of the co-directors of our campaign, three fantastic women leaders, Ava Smith, for example, you know, had been to the forefront of the 1983 campaign as well. So we were an intergenerational movement of women who had come together to transform how we do politics and to transform how women were perceived in Ireland. And the main goal that we had, obviously, was repealing the Eighth Amendment. So during that time, the 35 years, we endured a lot. We endured expert groups, parliamentary committees, green papers, we endured, you know, committee sessions. We had a case called the X case, which many of you will have heard of as well, which was a raped teenager who was refused access to an abortion. And her case went all the way to the Supreme Court, where they laid down the legal test under which an abortion could be accessed, I suppose, under the Eighth Amendment, which was real and substantial risk to life. We also endured three referendums on abortion. And each of those referendums, they were about travel, information, and whether suicide or mental or suicidal ideation could form part of risk to life. They were turned away by the people. So the people didn't want to restrict the abortion laws anymore. They wanted to provide information. They wanted people to be able to travel. We went through a series of cases, the so-called alphabet women, real women, real lives, real families, A, B, C, D, Miss D, X, Miss Y, you know, trundling, exposing their personal experiences in our courts, all over the newspapers, to the High Court, to the Supreme Court, to the European Court of Human Rights, to the UN Human Rights Committee, Amanda Mellett and Gráinne Whelan. You know, a shocking barrage of women and families having to expose themselves in order to be able to access their rights. And of course, we had Savita Halappanavar, that many of you will know as well, who tragically died because she was refused access to an abortion. And then in the background of all of this, I suppose, we had ongoing restrictions on rights around our maternal experiences. So I've given birth to two children in Irish hospitals, and it's not woman-centred. I received excellent care, but I gave birth in the shadow of the Eighth Amendment. My consent, my privacy, my autonomy, it wasn't to the forefront, because the medics were trained that the fetus had the exact same rights as me, and therefore I'm as always a second-class citizen within that transaction. We had symphysiotomy, which is breaking the pelvis of a woman in order to ease the passage of birth rather than doing a caesarean section. This is dark, right? But this is really important in terms of where we came from. That's the top line level picture. That's the nature of what women's reproductive health, what our autonomy, what our maternity services and access to abortion was in Ireland. That's how deep it was in our psyche, in our fascia. It was ingrained, it was divisive, we were oppressed. So what changed? So there we were, trundling along for 35 years, or maybe like if we take it even at 25 years, in this dark passage of oppression. Well, what changed? I have 5 points here, and there's quite a lot. And this is, of course, my narrative. There's another narrative as well. I suppose it's kind of important to say. There's many more narratives. And that's the pure beauty of this campaign. And Yes Equality, which came before us, which I'll talk to you about, is that there are many narratives. And we look at them, all those narratives, without judgment. They're all equal and they all mean something. And we all got there through following our hearts and our goals. So the main change was Ireland was blown apart by clerical sex abuse, the lack of accountability, the cover-up, the lack of compassion for victims. So that has been the big seismic change in Irish discourse over the last, you know, 30 years, whatever it might be. People's faith in the church plummeted. I suppose there was an exposure of systemic child abuse, and the social or the religious bonds between a people and its governing religious or its predominant religious faith really fell apart. The second thing is we had a huge upsurge of demonstrations, of alliances, of coalitions, of working together, of networks. And I mean, for the record, I suppose, there is no doubt that the abortion rights campaign, driven and powered by the young women, was a game changer in repealing the Eighth Amendment. Thirdly, then, human rights and the human rights movement. So what happened in Ireland in the, I suppose, kind of from around 2005, was our civil society sector, which had been very community and voluntary based, was professionalised somewhat more. And we had an injection of philanthropic funding, which really raised the game in terms of the national NGOs into becoming very strategic, very professional, target-driven, you know, thinking about outcomes and where we're actually going, rather than just doing activities because they were human rights activities or whatever it might be. So, for example, in the Irish Council for Civil Liberties, which is where I began my professional campaigning, and I would have been an abortion rights activist beforehand, our ethos was very much, because we were human rights based, it was participatory, and we always wanted to give space to the voice of the rights holder, so the women. So, for example, when ARC came along and other coalitions like the Coalition to Repeal the Eighth Amendment, we did everything that we could, maybe not always, I don't know, to support amplifying those voices as an independent human rights NGO. So providing professional support around going to the UN, raising things as a human rights issue, being an honest broker, bringing together alliances and coalitions. And that was the same with Yes Equality as well. So there's no doubt that that infrastructural civil society movement that we had really helped along with the grassroots mobilisation, or I suppose supported the grassroots mobilisation. The fourth thing is cultural politics, I think. And this is, I've lost my badge, but you will know the repeal jumpers. I was going to wear it, but it's so warm. So the repeal jumpers is a sign of the cultural politics. So popular culture in Ireland is quite politicised, I would say broadly, isn't it? Yeah, it's quite politicised. And when you're trying to transform how politics is done, or to move beyond what is seemingly an intractable issue like abortion rights, popular culture, it unites everyone. It brings joy, it brings hope, it brings creativity and vision, and it just it inspires you to get up in the morning when you're having to debate people like John McGurk, basically. So there's no doubt that that was really important. And then the last one I've picked out here is process. But there is no doubt that the processes that underpinned the passage of repeal really helped to shape it. And the two key processes was the Citizens' Assembly and the Oireachtas Committee and the Eighth Amendment. That's our parliamentary committee and the Eighth Amendment. So when the Citizens' Assembly was called, I got a phone call from Ava Smith, who was the convener of the Coalition to Repeal the Eighth, then a co-director of Together for Yes, long-time feminist activist. And she said, Deirdre, I need you to come to a meeting on Saturday because everyone's going wild about the Citizens' Assembly. And I need you to come in now and be a lawyer. And I was like, right, okay. And she said, I need you to tell them that it's a good thing. Okay? People were not happy with the Citizens' Assembly. They considered it a kick to touch, a ruse, a way of postponing it. And it's probably fair to say that it was a little bit. And I kind of tend to agree. It was political manoeuvres. But at the same time, sometimes politicians know things that we don't know. So maybe they knew that politics inside needed another process, where we were looking at it in a different way. So I said fine, obviously, and I went in. And because I'm a human rights lawyer, I believe in process. And I believe that the transformative nature of human rights is that it strips away power and it provides space for us to talk about a person, about rights, in a safe space without that charitable relationship or where power is just speaking to power. We can speak truth to power. And to me, that's what the Citizens' Assembly did. It allowed us to provide evidence, advocacy, persuasion, time, reflection. There is no doubt that the news reports and the media reports that came out of the Citizens' Assembly really impacted on people's understanding of the issue of abortion. The Citizens' Assembly was not perfect. And let's unpack that a little bit, because it could have gone other ways, right? But what was really impactful about the Citizens' Assembly is that it moved into a parliamentary committee. And what I want to leave with you about that parliamentary committee is the women parliamentarians, they worked that committee like I have never seen politicians work a committee before. There were at least three men on that committee who were not yes voters. And by the end of it, they were part of a political campaign. I was doing doorsteps with them and they were telling Middle Ireland to vote yes. Okay, so process works because it gives the space, it gives the time for the persuasion, for the information, for bringing more people into the room. So onto the campaign, how did we come together? Well, in my opinion, we came together, so we had three organisations, Claire's organisation, ARC, the Coalition to Repeal the Eighth, and the National Women's Council. But there were other organisations very closely interconnected as well, like Amnesty International, the Irish Family Planning Association. We came together through a shared narrative and messaging. And we worked for 2 years prior to the referendum being called on what the story, the narrative, the messaging should be. And we all sat around the table and we disagreed. And we did qualitative research and we reviewed the findings ourselves, focus groups, you know, clearly. And we were disappointed in some of the outcomes. We tried to understand more the outcome, what people were saying. And we did it collectively. Sometimes 17 of us around a table, you know, horrendous kind of stuff for like 3 or 4 hours. We were going, oh my God, like, do you know what I mean? But we did it and we did it for a long time and we got through it. So by the time the referendum was called, because there had been such an overwhelming result from the Citizens' Assembly and the Oireachtas Committee and the Eighth Amendment, which both recommended repeal, that we had a shared message. The messages that went up on our posters, sometimes a private matter needs public support, a woman you love may need your yes, we had them pretty much in the bank going in. We'd done our research, we were evidence-based, and we were not letting this behind. We were as prepared, or go behind, we were prepared as we could be. And in any campaign, you're looking for clarity, consistency, and a connection. They're the three things always looking for. And my job as campaign manager was to work with co-directors and the other leaders in the team to bring about a popular vote. And sometimes that was very hard. Ireland's a small country, but the popular vote, like most countries, sits in the urban cities. And it was tough in rural Ireland at points. But I will just say this, that rural Ireland also voted yes. So don't let anyone over here say to you, north, south, rural, urban, whatever it is, those barriers can be broken down. During the campaign, we're speaking to approximately a third of what we termed the concerned centre. So it's approximately a third. And they were soft and they were harder. Okay, so that's where our campaign really needed to focus its efforts. So brief word in social media. It's one of the things we did really well in the campaign. Our organic reach was phenomenal. But really what that was doing was it was mobilising our ground troops to get out the vote and to canvass. It wasn't really persuading anyone to vote yes. Okay? Facebook was persuading people to vote yes. And people were engaging with articles on Facebook. But the type of things they were engaging with on Facebook were trusted news sources. They weren't engaging with flashy ads or whatever it might be. And we knew that because we had quite a strong digital analytical process within the campaign. I talked about the messaging, the branding. Who told our story? One of the reasons why we won is because we had doctors and women telling our story. It wasn't people like me. It wasn't human rights people or co-directors of campaigns. It was women and doctors. They had no doctors because no doctor would come out and say that this was a good thing to have a woman's life at risk. They had a couple of, you know. So our message carriers, our tone and our values, we were persuasive, we were calm, we were reflective. We met people where they were. Very important that we weren't judging people if they were anti-choice. We were just trying to move them to a pro-choice position. Many people in Ireland identified as anti and pro-choice. There's an interesting one for you. The Zeitgeist was with us. We had the Me Too movement with a lot of that going on. We had, in the middle of our, just before our campaign, a Supreme Court case on when the unborn life started, in the womb or upon birth. You couldn't make that up. So we had an expedited Supreme Court case and it went our way. With the Home to Vote, the Register to Vote campaigns, our crowdfunding was, you know, the most successful that Ireland's ever seen, €5 per second on its day of launching. We had our disciplines and our systems because we weren't getting bright line fever. And I talked already about organic social media. Our challenges, poster wars, we didn't have as much money as them. I want to leave you with two. When we started off the referendum, there was 20% of the electorate who were considering voting yes were iffy about the 12 weeks proposal. So we have, you know, access to the pill up to 12 weeks in our legislation. What were we going to do about 12 weeks? If we were talking about 12 weeks this time last year, we were going to lose. So what we did with the 12 weeks is we went out front and centre on it and we owned it and we turned it into a positive. And we made people feel good about providing really good medical care to women and being sensible about it, and it worked. The big challenge, and I will be forever grateful, is left-leaning organisations that, and I would consider myself part of them, we've tended to fracture in the past. So to infight, to argue amongst each other, we're so concerned about our values and our principles and we're not thinking about the goal. We didn't have that. Now we did, but everyone sucked it up. I mean, the transgender community, you know, they were extremely hurt because our word was woman and girls. You heard me there in the radio. We couldn't take the chance to be putting in people because that was giving something away to the no side. And I get their hurt. And we tried to engage, we did engage with them. But, you know, they sucked it up because they were we were looking for a bigger prize. So I just want to leave you, I suppose, because now I'm coming to the end of my time, with two things. When the exit poll came out, we were in HQ and we didn't, that was at about 67, I think. Was it a 68 or something?
Yeah. Landslide.
Landslide was used. The Dixie Chicks would be forever remembered. So it's hard to describe what that was like. And Claire, you might have better words for it. But for me, because we had led this campaign, I actually just wanted to go into a room on my own because I couldn't take it in. But the overwhelming feeling that I have of that evening is, of course, the joy, of course, the tears, the sense of being overwhelmed by the sheer scale of it, the gratitude, bizarrely, because I don't think that we should have to ask for our rights, but still feeling gratitude that people have voted yes. But really what I actually saw in the air was stigma falling. I met girls that night that just started talking about having an abortion, just like that. It was the most incredible thing I've ever experienced. And it was a stigma falling, because it wasn't just a 51% or a 50.5. It was an inclusive, uniting vote. And why do I think people voted for repeal? I think we ran a better campaign. They fractured about 10, 12 days out. And we would say that, of course. But I think that the overriding reason why they did is because we managed to make a human connection. And we demonstrated as a repeal movement that we have empathy and that we put the human at the centre of what we're doing. And in the end, we're all looking for human connection, whether it's in politics, whether it's with your family, in life, whatever it is. And what we did in our campaign was we made our table warmer and safer and more inviting and less judgmental, empathetic. So when we look at Dublin Castle and we look at joy and flags and this transformative thing that we did to how politics operates and to what politics will be in the future, we did that by love and by empathy and by compassion and by fighting for our rights.
This is Social Power, a podcast from the Sheila McKechnie Foundation. We're looking at the campaign to repeal the Eighth Amendment of the Irish Constitution, which paved the way for women to access legal and safe abortion. Taking part are Deirdre Duffy, a human rights lawyer and campaign director of the Together for Yes Coalition, Dr. Claire Brophy, co-convener of the Abortion Rights Campaign, and Rachel Lavin, data journalist and partnerships coordinator with Who Targets Me. We then heard from Dr. Claire Brophy, co-convener of the Abortion Rights Campaign. She focused on the work done to build a strong network of activists and allies.
To go back sort of to the beginning a little bit, I'll talk a bit about ARC, the Abortion Rights Campaign. We set up in the year 2011 after there was an ad campaign run by a group called Youth Defence, who are an American-funded anti-choice group. And out of nowhere, and for no particular reason, apropos of nothing, they had a billboard campaign that depicted women crying, and the caption was, "Abortion tears her life apart." And suddenly, there was this community of people who were my age who'd never been involved before looking up and going, "What is this? Why are they talking about this? It makes no sense. I'm offended. One of my friends just had to travel to England. I'm angry for her." And so what came together was a group of people who were both experienced activists. There were people involved who'd been involved in 1983 for the anti-amendment campaign. There were people from 1992 who were involved with the X campaign, and with the referendum that happened during the X case, which was, do people have the right to travel for abortions? Yes. And does a risk of suicide constitute a risk to a person's life? Yes. That's how we voted. There were people who were involved from 1997, when there was another referendum on the right to information. And then there were people who were involved ever since. So there were all these sort of threshold moments in this movement where there had been a growth of people involved, and then we were beaten down again by apathy, by a broad society that was very, very conservative and very afraid to talk about anything to do with women's bodies, and especially anything to do with sexuality. So this was a complete end of the line in terms of taboo conversations in Ireland. This was it. And so a group of us came together in 2011, and we established what we call the Irish Choice Network. And we met again at the end of the year, and we changed our name to the Abortion Rights Campaign. Why? Because the word abortion has to be front and centre. It's everything. And how better to destigmatise a thing than by talking about it? And so from the very beginning, we're trying to establish that the discourse is ours and that we will own these words. And what came from that moment and that coming together, it was the initial snowball effect that led to our referendum campaign last year. From that group, that was established in 2011, several other groups sprang out. So AIMS, which is the Association for Improvements in Maternity Services, came into existence. Parents for Choice. It started to become commonplace for people to be openly out as being pro-choice. And then the other part of it was that Alva Smith established the Coalition to Repeal the Eighth. So the abortion rights campaign, our aim is free, safe, legal abortion for anyone who needs it. And that is our slogan, that's our handle on all social media. We don't negotiate in terms of what we want in those terms. But when you look at how we get abortion in Ireland, the Eighth Amendment was the barrier. It had been put in place in 1983 for the sole purpose of copper-fastening against any kind of abortion access in Ireland. One of the groups that was majorly involved, Spook, just lost a court case in Scotland. So these people aren't gone. They're still around. It was only the other day. But they very much targeted Ireland at the time off the back of Roe v. Wade, off the back of the McGee case, off the back of the Pope's visit in Ireland in 1979, which I personally think had a huge rallying effect for the very far-right conservative wing of religious zealots in Ireland. And what we got was the Eighth Amendment. And what happened after the Eighth Amendment was that Ireland kind of hollowed out. A lot of people emigrated. It was a really dark time in our history, and it was a really difficult place to live. I wasn't even born yet, but I've read about this and I've talked to people, and people are still traumatised about 1983 and what happened. And so in 2011 we came together and we decided that free, safe, legal had to be our focus. And that is the basis for our campaign. And once you have a campaign, you build a strategy. And our strategy was to repeal the Eighth Amendment. It had to be the first step. And so that is why we put everything behind repealing the Eighth Amendment. So we established, firstly, our structure as a group, because it has to be sustainable. And if you're establishing a campaign, you need to make sure that you as a group are going to be able to survive what will, if it's anything like our campaign, be brutal and very difficult. And so our structure in ARC is non-hierarchical. What that means is that there are working groups that attend to different areas of the campaign. So we have one group called Policy and Advocacy that focuses a lot on government policy, and we make submissions to the UN all the time. And we have another working group that's called Direct Actions that is about organising marches, demos, and any kind of creative direct action that we need to do. They are equally as important, because what we were doing was building a structure that was coming at the issue from the grassroots and from above. And trust me when I say the Irish government, maybe it's a post-colonial thing, they really want people to like them internationally. They're really, really desperate to be beloved. It's, I don't know, there's more to that. But anyway, we had to come at it from underneath and from above. And so that is why the structure is the way it was. Non-hierarchy means that activists can get involved, you can opt in, you can move, if you want, from group to group within the campaign, or you can move based on the projects that we're working on at the time. But when the time comes that you need a break, you can step back. And that was everything, because it prevents burnout. But what you do retain is the experience and the enthusiasm of very good campaigners. So when the time comes and you need them to come back, because it's shoulder to the wheel, they will come back. And this is what we saw last year. We have now 6 working groups, and then what we established in the 2013 is when we started to really focus on regional groups. And we had 40 regional groups all around the Republic of Ireland. Alliance for Choice is a group that exists in Belfast and in Derry, as I'm sure you well know. The north of Ireland is a different jurisdiction legally, so they have a different set of challenges. But they have absolutely been incredible allies, and they did amazing work, and they came across the border to help canvass last year, and they sort of came to our rescue. It was really kind of humbling to see this sort of support come across from our sisters in the north. But these regional groups that we established, what we did from 2013 on was establish really close relationships with activists all over the country. We gave them support, and we gave them a space in which to have conversations. And this is where resources come in. So if you're looking for resources from supportive other people, one of the best things that you can ask for is their experience. And what we shared with all the regional groups was training. And there's 2 kinds of training that we did. One was values clarification. Why do you care about this? What is it that you care about when you talk about this issue? Why does it matter to you? And for the issue of abortion in Ireland, it was really, really important for us to clarify, in terms of values, the difference between good abortion and bad abortion, because we had to be together on this. You can't be in favour of free, safe, legal abortion if you think that certain people are entitled to this healthcare and certain people aren't. So this can't be a case that we're only going to fight for abortion in cases of rape or fatal fetal abnormality or incest, in cases where it's only been put upon the person seeking the abortion. It had to be for everyone. And so these values clarifications actually opened up a conversation so that people could be empowered to talk about the issue and actually ask these questions of themselves and of each other. Why is this very important? And what this always comes back to then is that it's a healthcare issue and it's a question of empowerment and human rights. The other kind of training that went on was media training, which it might sound like it's only a small facet of actually what is involved with activism, but really what you're doing by doing media training is empowering people to talk about this very difficult issue to someone who's going to ask you questions, who's not necessarily on your side. If you can do that, you can do anything. I once did a debate in Irish about abortion with a man who I shocked, I think, so much by saying the word vagina in Irish that the radio host thought the line had dropped. But these, if you can talk about abortion in public and debate it with people who don't agree with you, you can talk about anything. And so this was a really empowering phase of training that we did with people all over the country. And then what we had with that structure was a huge swathe of very empowered leaders all over the country, with people who could talk about these issues in their local areas and people who could lead trainings in their local areas and talk to people who were very clear in their mind about what they believe, very clear about the reasons why, and very clear on how to talk about it when the time comes. So after strategy comes tactics, and this is sort of all of the work that you're going to do. It could be that you're making submissions to something that you perceive as higher up. It could be international rights bodies, but it's also about appealing to the grassroots. And when it came to last year, what we had to do was go back out to all of these groups, these abortion rights campaign groups, all over the country and say, we are now part of Together for Yes. We are one of the three constituent groups of Together for Yes. And so what we're fighting for right now is not necessarily free, safe, legal. It is one step on the way. It is repealing the Eighth Amendment. And we had to have this very clear focus on that issue. And so we were able to use all the capacity that we had built up over years of work all over the country and all of these really empowered people with our structure that builds up people and builds up a sense of empowerment to discuss what is, as I say, the hardest thing to talk about in public. And they were able to lead canvasses all over the country and knock on people's doors and ask them, how are you going to vote next week? What I would say is one of the most kind of striking things I think about Together for Yes is, and I'm not sure if it's clear from afar, but it's the word together in the title. And it's everything. It is essentially the bones of what we had to do, as Deirdre kind of alluded to. We had to pull together. So there was a lot of setting aside of egos, and there was a lot of setting aside of our values. There were sacrifices made by so many groups who were only unified by this one issue. And the Coalition to Repeal the Eighth was a group that was set up by Alva Smith and Sinead Kennedy. And so what they did was bring together over 100 groups from all over the country, representing all kinds of different people, but who were all unified on the question of repealing the Eighth. Is this something that you want to do? Yes. What was brilliant was that allowed for a space where there were people who were in favour of repealing the Eighth, maybe not necessarily in favour of free, safe, legal, but over time and over these conversations, that may have actually happened kind of by osmosis, because how can your values possibly allow for anything less than free, safe, legal, which is what we have in certain circumstances for some people. And this is still a problem, and the work is still ongoing, as I'm sure you well know. But so much of the work is pulling people together. And I can't stress enough, and it is something that happens on the left, and it's something that we're all prey to, I suppose, is the sense that our righteous indignation might cause rifts where we can't avoid them. We have so much more in common than we don't. And very rarely will these fallouts of relationships occur because of the issue. We almost all agree on the issue. So focus on the issue. Focus on the campaign. Look to the strategy. Lean into your structure. And you'll get there. You'll have to make sacrifices. It will be difficult. But we have more in common. And we are so much stronger together. And so that means appealing to groups who you've not necessarily represented in your own groups. It means intersectionality. It means bringing into the room people whose voices you haven't necessarily listened to before. Maybe you haven't actually thought to include their voices before, but it is a great strength of our movements on the left to have that diversity. It's a phenomenal strength, and it's something that our adversaries do not have and they do not value. So there's a way to do that and to bring everything together. And if the work is done in pulling everything together and pulling everyone in and keeping everyone looped in, circle the wagons, that's how things like what happened in Ireland last year actually happen. It's the together of Together for Yes.
Finally, Rachel Lavin of Who Targets Me reflected on the use of social media and the spread of misinformation.
I got the luxury of taking sort of an observant role in this election. I'm a journalist and particularly a data journalist. So I sort of had to step back from the emotional, you know, strain this campaigns took and got to just look at how it was playing out. My main thing I was passionate about was a fair, honest and open debate playing out online. So the context of the Irish abortion referendum happening was it was one of the first major electoral events, particularly in the West, after the Cambridge Analytica scandal had hit and the 2016 election in the US and then obviously Brexit here in the UK. So the big question, I felt like the whole world was looking at us and how we were going to handle it. How are we going to run such a divisive, such an emotional issue fairly with what's happening online. There was also Facebook, Google and Twitter are based in Ireland thanks to our very generous tax laws. So they were sort of in a way wanted to put up a good front and they were right accessible to us. We could go into their offices and lobby them particularly. The government particularly would be probably one of the leaders in potential to regulate as a European hub for those tech companies. So they were nervous. And then we also had the entire world looking at how we're handling like misinformation online, but also looking at how the abortion, it almost became a proxy for the abortion debate worldwide. So we had all these American and European groups targeting us online and getting involved in the debate. So we just felt like a petri dish for both disinformation, the abortion campaign, and how governments and tech companies would self-regulate themselves, which was a lot. Like, we're a very small island, a small population. It felt very momentous at the time. So with the Transparent Referendum Initiative, which was formed by Liz Carlin and Craig Dwyer, who are sort of academics, data scientists, other academics like Diane Payne, who sadly passed away recently, they got involved and just decided to get together as many people interested in the issue of how to make sure this was a fair debate online. And then we had journalists get involved, and that's sort of where I came in. I got journalists to collaborate, which is unheard of in Ireland. Mm-hmm. It was something I learned here via Bureau of Investigative Journalism, the Bureau Local, which does fantastic work. It was that idea of getting people to put their competition aside. We had a definite deadline and we had too many stories that we could individually get out. So we got them all in a room together and made them work on the data, which we collected from Who Targets Me, who I now work for. So Who Targets Me is an extension you can add to your Chrome browser. And at the time, we were the only tool for people to see the ads being targeted at people on Facebook. So we were able to analyse the campaigns as they played out. So it's so interesting to hear you guys talk about your tactics, because I was analysing your campaign via Facebook while also analysing the no side. So one of the things I saw with the Facebook, I also looked at Twitter and the kind of bubbles that were forming, the repeal shield, which was used to deter people who were being particularly, you know, offensive and crude online. And then there was also some like fake websites we analysed. So with the repeal, what I noticed was, looking at your campaign over time, you guys were pushing people offline. So it was really, really interesting, because the medium is the message, right? So we were looking at online has played such a role everywhere else. If you look at the amount of money you can now see, thanks to Facebook's ad library report, how much money is going into Facebook campaigning. It's where politicians are putting all their money, because they think that is where the decisions are being made. But in Ireland, we actually still have really, really strong civic activism. So if you go to Ireland now, you'll see the posters for the European election candidates and the local candidates all over the polls. I mean, it's terrible for the environment, but it is a sign, like, don't see it as much as in the UK, of this, like, constant awareness of around major electoral events and what's happening. You also have canvassing, so I'm not really sure how strong canvassing is as a tool here, but it's like a really prolific, you know, Irish people, gift of the gab. You constantly have people coming to your door knocking and having the conversation. And that thing you said about having those conversations in real life, there was the localised groups, which is just like such a clever campaign. So they had Together for Yes as the brand. I love that idea that you shared the message across the country. Again, you put your differences aside, united under the one banner of Together for Yes. And then they were pushing out fundraising events and canvassing events and come to this event and talk about this. I wasn't seeing that on the Save the Eight, the No side. They were pushing, you guys were pushing a lot of fundraising as well, even though the No side were saying you were getting all this George Soros funding or whatever, and the No side weren't doing that at all. The No side had all of their campaign online. They were constantly pushing disinformation, smear tactics, and we saw a lot of evidence of foreign interference. At one point, we tracked down some kind of Catholic institution that had set up a war room in Dublin to spread out disinformation and really divisive slogans to the Irish people. So what we did was we exposed it as it was happening. There was articles going out every day about all the things that were going down. And basically a constant awareness that you cannot trust what you're seeing online. Revert then to the real world. Revert then to the people you know and the stories you trust, which you guys played upon. Like, talk to your friends, the women in your lives. The No campaign were pushing out really dirty tactics. And again, the Yes campaign played it so clean. I don't think I saw anything that was slightly off or could have been conflated as being a dirty tricks. But we saw a lot of it. So the dirty tricks were had a backfiring effect. Every time the No side put out a smear campaign, a disinformation article, we spotted it on our Facebook ads database collected by Who Targets Me. We pushed it out via the various news organizations which shared the story, and we had a constant WhatsApp group monitoring stuff, updating each other when we saw something dodgy, and we turned those into stories. And the public were aware of the dirty ticks that were played by the No side. And it had this huge backfiring effect where they knew they couldn't trust the No side. The No side were being, as you said, increasingly hectic and frantic and dishonest. And as a result, people again reverted back to speaking to the people they knew in their lives. And I think it might have never happened. I mean, looking at the online campaign, I did think the No side were going to win. And I guess after being exposed to so much bile and weird stuff on the internet, you do start to get pessimistic. But because it, maybe if they had won it online, it didn't matter because the debate didn't happen online as much in Ireland. It happened on the ground. I don't know if you'll have the luxury of that here as much. I mean, a lot of money is being put into online, but it's important to remember there were other factors that made it be a yes vote. But again, there was a strong online campaign by the yes side that I think people can learn a lot from.
After hearing from Irish campaigners, we went on to discuss what campaigners in the UK could learn from their experiences. Some of the practical challenges our audience were keen to embrace were being better at solidarity, collaboration and power sharing, using digital tools to enable real-world activism and the face-to-face conversations that were so important in the referendum campaign, and enabling the non-judgmental conversations that can create space for people to really listen, learn and deliberate about an issue. We're not able to include the full conversation here, but we'll be publishing a report of the event online. Follow our Twitter feed at SMK Campaigners for the latest on this and other social change news. You've been listening to Social Power, a podcast from the Sheila McKechnie Foundation. This special edition was based on an event sponsored by the Joseph Rowntree Reform Trust. If you've enjoyed the podcast, please rate, review and share it with a friend or colleague. You can find out more about the Social Change Project at www.smk.org.uk.